Hi guys, Barry here. Just before you listen to this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward, all about the world's worst weapon, a couple of things. First of all, this is a Patreon-supported episode. Our Patreon supporter, Johnny Rex, donates at least $5 a month to the show, which entitles him to suggest the topic of an episode. He chose World's Worst Weapon, I think inspired by seeing a book of the same name. And so hopefully we have done you proud, Johnny. We have roped in the military correspondent for the Daily Telegraph, a proper actual military man. And I spend a lot of the episode talking about making bombs out of different animals. So usual Worst Foot Forward fare there. And most of all, thank you very much, Johnny, for supporting us. And indeed, thank you to all of our Patreon supporters. We love you very dearly. The other thing to say is our very first live recording is coming up. Our live show at the Vault Festival in Waterloo, where Ben and I will be recording an episode of Worst Foot Forward. We're throwing the world's worst dinner party. We're going to be joined by three former guests of the show. We'll probably be announcing one of those each week for the next 3 weeks, so keep an ear out for that. We'll be eating some food from the Futurist's Cookbook and getting the audience to vote on the various worsts we're going to talk about over the course of a whole hour. So if you want to come and join us, we've already sold about 20% of the tickets, I think. So if you want to come along, it's at the Vault Festival in Waterloo. Visit vaultfestival.com and look up Worst Foot Forward in the search bar there. You can get tickets 4:30 p.m. on the 29th of February in London. How exciting. And if a load of you come along to that, well, maybe we'll do more. We're already thinking about what we would do for the next one. So I hope we'll see a few of you at that. As ever, you can follow us online if you look up at Worst Foot on Twitter, find Worst Foot Forward on Facebook, visit worstfootforwardpodcast.com, or send an email to worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com if you want to hear and see even more of us. Now, just settle back and enjoy this week's episode. Apologies in advance, I had a cold while we were recording this. I may sound a little bit weird in places, but, you know, no more weird than normal, I'm sure. Enjoy! Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast where each week we aim to discover the best of the worst. I'm Ria Gunnar Vanderveld, and this week you find us in the Worst Foot Forward armory, making sure we're well tooled up for the coming world war. However, due to a terrible typo, we actually find ourselves in the Worst Foot Forward armoire, with myself, my co-host, and our guest playing sardines in a decorative wardrobe full of muskets. Not to worry, though, if carry-on movies have taught me anything, then the three of us can rustle up some disguises using the moth-eaten ball gowns and tailcoats on the hangers, turn a pair of braces into a homemade catapult, and show any passing Goliath that we're not to be messed with. And sat opposite me is my partner in crime, the collateral damage to my mass destruction, Barry McStay.
Funny enough, Rear Gunner is a nickname that I've been called as well in my time. I don't think either of us would do well in the coming war, let's be honest.
Oh no, mate, we're going to be part of the entertainment corps.
Oh yeah! Is that still a thing?
Yeah, it totally is. I've got friends who've been out to Iraq and Afghanistan and have entertained people there, but also friends who go to Cyprus where decompression happens.
Yeah.
And so, and it's, and at first, one of them told me about it, the most, not famous in terms of TV famous, but famous on the circuit, there's a guy called Andy Askins, who goes that all-time brilliant Comedy Store headliner. He's been given like medals for doing it, and he says it's an essential part of the decompression because it's sort of welcoming soldiers back into the real world.
Because I love all the stories about like the likes of Kenneth Williams and and the goons who were all in the entertainment corps out in the, like, the goons were a bit in the war, and then Kenneth Williams was in the entertainment corps in like Malaysia or something, or Malaya back in the day.
Yeah.
And how they all like got together, and then you're like, well, of course, obviously there's got to be no society after World War III, so we don't have that happy future to look forward to.
It's just going
to
be a television half buried in the sand with Mrs. Brown's Boys playing on a loop over and over
after
again.
After the bomb drops, the only things that will survive will be cockroaches and episodes of Mrs. Brown's
and
Boys.
And Keith Richards. Watching it with the cockroaches.
Our guest this week originally served for 23 years in the British Army. with deployments in Afghanistan, the Balkans, Northern Ireland and Iraq. And how nice to see the old favourite coming around for a revival yet again. He was originally a cavalry officer in the Royal Scots Dragoon Guards. And yes, for non-UK listeners, that did involve him serving alongside Daenerys Targaryen. He later transferred to the Army Air Corps, where he flew Gazelle helicopters. And spoiler alert, given some of my choices for this week's topic of World's Worst Weapon, it genuinely wouldn't surprise me if those were just metal bulbs with centrifugal antelopes for rotors. He is now the defence and security correspondent for the British newspaper The Daily Telegraph, demonstrating that even dyed-in-the-wool Green Party voters like Ben and myself can broaden our horizons beyond the quinoa and hemp-infused pages of The Guardian. He is only here, as he told us himself, because he's pretty sure World War III isn't going to start today. Which, in this blighted modern world, is about as close to hope as we can get these days. Please welcome Dominic Nichols.
Hello, boys. Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it. I have been wrong about many, many things, so if it does
well, it's only go up 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so we've 10 more hours.
So I can only apologise if war does break out. It's partly my fault.
If your phone suddenly starts beeping like in an episode of The West Wing with a different dial tone to what we normally expect, things have gone down.
Well, do you have? I know, like sort of like in pubs, they have on the wall like a Deadpool, or in the sports department, they've maybe got a prediction of who's going to be the top scorer in the Premier League.
Yeah,
and the sort of in the military end of the Daily Telegraph, have you got like a sweepstake on when war's going to break out or where it's going to break out next?
Well, I mean, there's almost no point in trying that, because as we've seen over the last couple of weeks, you know, the Orange Man just changes everything.
He's a real rogue, like, factor to try and, you know, cause of World War III could be, like, you know, tension in the Middle East. It could be terrorists getting their hands on a weapon. It could be Trump just eating a really bad, you know, biryani.
A biryani, like he's going to eat anything.
Food poisoning in his KFC.
Yeah.
No, I was lucky enough in bunny years to be in the small press pool to meet him a couple of weeks ago.
Really?
He was over the NATO conference. Yeah. It's just like on the telly. It's just this guy who just talks. It's about sort of 5,000 words that you just have to sort of cut and splice and get your article out of that, because he wanders off and it's just extraordinary. I asked him a question at one point about North Korea and Kim Jong-un, and I can't remember what it was, but it was probably something startling and insightful, and, you know, as you'd expect. But he sort of blathered on about a different country completely, and then just sort of wheeled around at me, sort of smiled this sort of massive great grin, and sort of, you know, mix of sort of white and orange thing, and then said, "But he does like sending up those rockets, doesn't he?" And I just thought, I've seen this cartoon and it doesn't look well. Oh, it's extraordinary.
You're sort of expecting the mask to come off and it just to be Rob Reiner and Mel Brooks operating.
I think that it's not just journalism anymore. You have to act as like an interpreter.
It's catnip to a journalist. Of course, it's just great. Yeah, just point anything and you get a great quote and funny story. But we're almost kind of past that, because everyone sort of knows what you're going to get. So there is no story. He says something shocking and inflammatory and, you know, offensive to many, many people. So what?
It's the new normal. That's the dangerous thing, is that, you know, people will say, oh, so-and-so pushes the boundary. And the boundary has been pushed so far now that there's so much space where there previously wasn't, even if you don't go as far as Trump now, which is...
In your job, are you mostly talking or writing about sort of the day-to-day life of a soldier, or are you thinking more about the big international policy?
So I'm the only defence and security guy at the Telegraph. So the answer is yes, all of that. I mean, I've got there's various people that take various information, news, entertainment out of the defence and security areas. So I've got to sort of cater for all of that. I've got to follow the news. I can't, like this week, I can't just kind of say, look, I'm not interested in Iran. I've got a great story on something else. So, you know, I've got to follow the news. It's a newspaper on the online side as well. But yeah, I mean, I try and shine a light into all those other places that just don't get a look in. So an MOD are good. MOD are very good, but they
that's the Ministry of Defence over here. Sorry, for people who don't necessarily know. No, that's good.
But they'll put out a press statement that's just beautifully crafted. Yeah, a couple of lines and a nice comment, and then this, that, and the other. So you, because obviously all they want to do is just get it and print it, put it straight in the paper. So I try and dig behind the headlines of that. And so in the kind of, for example, the diversity issue and inclusion, they'll give you all sorts of stats on how many people they've got from this fraternity, and it's just so
dull. I hate it. But I managed to meet a guy who's he's the first Royal Navy officer in the Defence Rastafarian Network. And I thought, well, that's amazing. I've never heard of the Defence Rastafarian Network. So I kind of, what on earth is that? And he gave me a great story that there's about 300 strong, and they've been in, they've been recognised by the military as a formed body for a couple of years now, so they can sort of represent themselves and their any problems they've got, or any sort of ways of making their religion and culture, the two sides of Rastafarianism, better able to work with the military to keep the people they got and hopefully recruit other people. And I thought, that is a great diversity and inclusion story. It's come from the horse's mouth, so to speak, without all this spin of being, you know, we've got to get this in, you've got to get that in, and we've got to sort of virtue signal this and all the rest of it. So I go out and find those stories to highlight areas of defence that you wouldn't have otherwise known existed. I mean, do you know?
I didn't know. Yeah. And I guess that's the thing, like, any history isn't just the dates and the headlines and the monarchs and stuff. Actually, the interesting history stuff is that stuff, is the day-to-day, what's happening on the ground. Just while I saw it on your CV, what is a dragoon?
The dragoon guards were the heavy cavalry, so literally the big, fat, heavy, famous charge of the Light Brigade.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why is it called the Light Brigade? Everyone thinks of lightsabers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
There was the Light Brigade, which was one of the worst British military charges in history. It took place one day later and one valley over in Crimea from the charge of the Heavy Brigade, which was one of the most successful cavalry charges ever.
But you did not as good a poem, did you?
We are not interested.
Doesn't scan, that's the problem.
So heavy horses that would go smashing through the enemy, or light horses for nipping around. Then moved on. When we developed tanks and all that kind of stuff, those lighter roles that were the sort of the lancers, morphed into the smaller, lighter, nippier tanks, and then the dragoons and the hussars, those big, heavy horses, came to be the big, heavy tanks. And that's all where we are now. It's slightly changing now because we can't afford all that stuff, but that's generally what it is. Dragoons and hussars were the big, heavy thumpers.
Ooh, cool.
And the lancers and the sort of lighter role.
I think they are the cool titles to have if you're a dragoon or hussar.
Yeah, my only previous interaction with a dragoon was playing Sid Meier's Civilization 2.
Yeah.
They were the upgrade that you really wanted to get as early as possible because they could nip all over the map and cause havoc.
Well, we've learned that you're very obviously insightful and good at sniffing out an interesting angle on your story. What are you the worst at in the world?
So I think I represent the worst type of people to be given military equipment to play with.
Sorry, have you met us? In what way?
Well, I look at my mates from the Army Air Corps days that I went out with on Tuesday night for just a quiet drink, and then the wheels came off. And it's just the same, it's always been the same. And so these guys, I don't know how we were trusted to fly helicopters, drive tanks, and all the rest of it. And so, yeah, I'm afraid I'm part of that cohort. So when I first met my in-laws now, for example, they live just outside Chesterfield up in Derbyshire. It's a nice open area. So the first time I saw them, I flew over in my helicopter and stuck it in the field next to their house and went in for lunch. And
I mean, that's a great entrance as a prospective son-in-law.
It's not pulling up in like a Honda 50.
So, and I just think, I mean, it was entirely, that was a useful training exercise to fly through different aerospace in the UK region and had a nice lunch.
I think this more, maybe it's every country, but I think sort of like the infrastructural spine of this country, when you realise what pissheads they all are. Like when you first go to university and go, well, the medics are all hammered every night, and then the lawyers, they're all going at it as well. And then, I mean, I remember there's a friend of mine who ended up going to work, he did work for the MOD on intelligence, and I can't remember what it was, but he was the biggest stoner in my year at university. So I think if you want some,
opened his doors of perception very high.
Yes, he did. Well, I think he was sort of like trying to prepare for working for the MOD in the 1890s. And it's like, I'll just follow the Silk Road, you know, get to know the culture around there. We're going to talk about the world's worst weapon. And Barry, you're going to go first.
I started by... just went to America very briefly, as we occasionally dip in there on this podcast, and because obviously arms control laws over there are a major source of debate. But they have the right idea in Alabama, where it's against the law to sell or use stink bombs. Yeah. Guns, fine, absolutely fine. Stink bombs are a no-no in Alabama. And in Aspen, Colorado, it's unlawful to throw stones, snowballs, or discharge guns or other missiles. It shall be unlawful for any person to throw any stone, snowball, or other missile, or discharge any bow, blowgun, slingshot, gun, catapult, or other device upon or at any vehicle, building, or other private or public property. Which begs the question, when were people besieging buildings in Aspen that they had to pass a law against catapults?
Yeah. I mean, they have to wonder. I mean, Dennis the Menace would have a...
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't specify what size of catapult, whether it's like the little handheld one or the actual proper...
I'd like to hope it was like a trebuchet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Going up against like a lovely little ski lodge in Colorado.
Nip it in the bud.
Gateway weapon. Pin end of the wedge. Do you remember Mueller?
Sorry, I just have to say, isn't a gateway weapon a siege engine?
Done. Do you remember Moab?
Oh, yeah.
The mother of all bombs. Yeah.
Which war was that? Iraq War II?
No, this was dropped in 2017 against an ISIS tunnel complex in Afghanistan. Yes. In April 2017, and at the time of the development, it was meant to be the most powerful non-nuclear weapon in the American arsenal. They made a big deal of this acronym, MOAB. It was around the time we were also coming around to remember to describing people as GOAT, greatest of all time. So yeah. People were big into that stuff. That just led me to... This is completely off topic, but reading about MOAB and the mother of all bombs led me to a term which I'd never heard of, and it's just too interesting to not tell you about it. Have you heard of a snow clone?
No, but I'm on one.
Apparently, yeah. Delicious. It's apparently it's a neologism from journalistic cliches. I'm sure you would never stoop to using one of those. No. Basically, it's a phrasal template that can be used and recognised in multiple variants. For example, in space, no one can, or the mother of all, or X is the new Y, or to X or not to X, or have X will travel. And the reason it's called a snow clone is because of people using that thing, for example, oh, there are as many jokes in Ben Vandervelde's set as there are Eskimo words for snow, that right. sort of thing. So the fact that this thing was being used a lot, Eskimo words for snow, is where the term snow clone comes from.
Huh.
And so Moab is one of those, mother of all bombs.
Nice.
There you go, your word of the day, people. Then I started to read about weapons, you know, proper weapons, but en route, stopped off at things that got invented by accident in the military. Super glue. Was invented by accident. A guy called Dr. Harry Coover, he's trying to make clear plastic gun sights to be put on Allied weapons during World War II. And one of the plastic formulations he came up with didn't work, but was very, very quickly bonding adhesive. That wasn't what he was working on at the time, so he completely forgot about it. And then 10 years later, working for Kodak, he was working at a new project and basically rediscovered it again. So he invented it by accident twice and went on to... this time he's like...
I'm just trying to get a job.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, well, this time Kodak were like, oh, that's a great idea. So Kodak started to sell it with a very non-catchy name of Eastman No. 910, but later renaming it Super Glue.
910. Yeah, that sounds like the sort of thing that you'd put on your hair.
Yeah. No, he made, obviously, lots and lots of money. And there is a story that it was discovered by soldiers during World War II to use it to seal up battle wounds. That's not true, but what is true is that apparently during the Vietnam War, Coover said, Super Glue was used to close up wounds on soldiers while they were being transported to hospital to receive stitches.
I'm sure I've read somewhere that Jackie Chan used to do that after one of his many falls during the stunt. Yeah, he would, you know, just hold the bits of skin together and wait till someone brought some Super Glue along.
Or just close it up with the power of his mind, I imagine.
And sniff the glue until someone came up with a decent...
Yeah.
Pain relief.
Yeah. I discovered one of those people that you just wish you'd heard of before now. This is a guy called Lonnie Johnson, who is an engineer who worked on the Galileo and Cassini satellite programs. He worked at NASA. He helped develop the B-2 stealth bomber. He's a prodigious creator. He holds more than 120 patents of things for like lithium batteries and electrochemical conversion systems. And in 1979, he was working for the US Air Force, and he patented a device that optically reduces binary code to scale and then uses magnifying lenses to retrieve the information. Basically, the technology used in CDs and DVDs.
Hmm.
He missed that one, basically. He says, I caught it the big fish that got away because I was enjoying my day job so much. He didn't pursue it commercially. But in 1986, he received US patent 4,591,071 for a device. And I quote from the patent application. A nozzle for ejecting water at high velocity, a pressurization pump for compressing air into the gun to pressurize water contained therein, and a trigger-actuated flow control valve for shooting the gun by controlling flow of pressurized water through the nozzle, a battery-powered oscillator circuit, and a water flow-powered sound generator to produce futuristic space ray gun sound effects when the gun is shooting. The application was simply titled Squirt Gun. Later on, the Super Soaker. Yes!
Amazing!
This guy, who worked for NASA and the US Air Force, developed the Super Soaker. And yeah, it was the result of an accident. He was working on something else, a heat pump. It sprung a leak and just shot a spray of water across the room. He went, oh, that'll make a great toy gun. And he made a prototype of it, and he licensed it to the Laramie Corporation. It was originally marketed as the Power Drencher. And then they went, not selling as well as it should, relaunched it as Super Soaker. And in 1992, its first year as Super Soaker, $10 each. It sold $200 million in sales. It was the top-selling toy in the world that year.
How excited are kids going to be when they found out that they've got a Super Soaker and they've got their hands on actual American military hardware?
Yeah. The same dude, Lonnie Johnson, by the way, also patented the Nerf Blaster. The Nerf guns, those little soft darts. He's also done those. He was born about 70 years ago in the segregated South. He's a black guy, African-American. His parents picked cotton on his grandfather's farm. He attended an all-black high school. And he graduated from Tuskegee University before joining the US Air Force as an engineer, and then later worked for NASA. And he is the inventor of the Super Soaker. Nowadays, he's working on creating a battery that you could drive a car cross-country on a single charge. He's also working on a water condenser that can pull moisture from ambient air, and a device that pulls heat from engines, particularly looking at the nuclear systems that are going to power long space flight.
What
an amazing dude. But the Super Soaker is the thing he's going to be most remembered for.
Gravestone.
Yeah. But Ben, on the show, God damn it, we love when people kill animals for no good reason. I've dived down the rabbit hole of animals used as weapons in war.
And it's a rabbit hole full of rabbit corpses.
Full of rabbit corpses, yeah. Anti-tank dogs. You might have heard of these. They're fairly well known, I think, now at this point. Particularly during World War II, the Red Army were trying to stop the Germans advancing on the Eastern Front. And they trained 40,000 dogs for various tasks. The idea being they'd strap a bomb to the dog, it would walk under the German tank, and it would blow up, killing the dog, but disabling the tank. Originally, they started that like the dog would have to shrug a bomb off its back and leave it and then escape. And they're like, oh, that doesn't really work. What they do...
Yeah, because dogs can't shrug.
Yeah, no. They just sort of shake their heads. Yeah,
no, unless they're Jewish dogs.
Notoriously non-ambivalent creatures, the dog. But no, they eventually devise a thing where the dog would have... And you can see pictures of them. They'd have like a lever sticking out of a thing strapped to their back, which was high enough that when it walked under the tank, the tank's floor would press the lever downwards and detonate the bomb. The problem arose, though, when they sent Soviet-trained dogs out into the battlefield that, A, they were being shot at, which hadn't been happening under training conditions. Not only that, the tanks were moving, which had not been happening because they were saving fuel during the training process. And, most important of all, they had been trained using Soviet tanks, which use a different fuel to the German tanks. So some dogs sent out onto a battlefield smelt the fuel in the Soviet tanks, recognised the tanks that they'd been trained with, and went trotting off underneath those instead. Not the most successful project in human history. In fact, they did shoot a few of them. The Germans did shoot a few of these dogs, captured them, looked at the corpses, saw what had been attached to them, and basically decided... It was such a... The Russians were worried the Germans would steal the technology. The Germans were like, this is such a stupid idea. We're not going to do that.
Not even going to bother defending it.
In fact, a German propaganda campaign actually capitalised on it by saying the Soviet soldiers were so scared to fight, they sent dogs out instead.
Oh, that's such a bad backfire.
Yeah. Gosh. I read about a lady called Olga of Kiev. In the early 10th century, Prince Igor of Kiev was on the throne of the Kievan Rus, and he travelled to meet one of the tribes that owed him tribute, the Drevelians. And when he demanded more tribute than the Drevelians thought he was owed, they decided to kill him. and his wife, Olga, took over rule of the Rus. The Trevelyans weren't keen on having a woman in charge, so they sent 20 of their best men to negotiate a marriage between her and Prince Mal, a Trevelyan who they'd end up basically ruling this entire little empire. Olga got her army to dig a trench large enough to drop all 20 ambassadors into it and buried them alive.
Wow.
She then sent word to Prince Mal that she accepted his proposal, but required that the Trevelyans send their most distinguished suitors to accompany her on the voyage. So basically they'd come, collect her, bring her back. Why they sent these dudes, I have no idea, but as soon as they did, she invited them into a bathhouse to clean up, lock the door, and set the place on fire.
Wow.
Then she held a funeral feast in honour of her dead husband, and she invited the Trevelyans to attend. And it was very, very merry affair. They got very drunk, and then her army proceeded to kill 5,000 of them. They keep falling in like for the same trick over and over. It's like someone's tapping them on the shoulder and then going around the other side and then trapping that one, and they just keep looking.
Yeah, like the Trojan horse only worked once.
Yeah, no, she kept getting these guys. But where the animals and weapons come in is that she granted the survivors of that massacre at the funeral feast mercy on the basis that each house in the Trevelyan lands would send her 3 pigeons and 3 sparrows as a tribute. Once the animals arrived, she ordered her army to tie a sulfur-bound cloth to each of the animals, then sent them back one night so that they would all arrive at once, roost in their nests at the eaves of the houses of the Trevelyans, and set each one of them on fire. Yeah, so the Trevelyans fled the city. She ordered the army to recapture every one of them, execute a load of them, sell the rest into slavery, and then ordered her army to burn the rest of the Trevelyan city to the ground.
I mean, that would have looked impressive, just seeing all these little feathers, like, going up, like tiny little avian fireworks.
Yeah, that's to be fair. The Catholic Church did see some use in her, because they later made her a saint.
Obviously had some bad first dates.
Yeah. literal Tinder profile.
Yeah.
I'm very close to our choice, but one quick stop in at one of our old favourites on the show, the Special Operations Executive from World War II.
Oh, great.
We love those dudes. The people who gave us Her Majesty's pornographers were at it again during World War II, where they decided they would invent the rat bomb. the first idea was they'd get 100 rats, 100 dead rats, kill them doing medical experiments, and then sew plastic explosives inside them. They would then drop them near, you know, factories and power stations and stuff in Germany. And someone who'd find them, which most likely thing to do would be to chuck it into a nearby boiler to chuck the corpse in. Of course, as soon as you do that with a bomb, it would blow up so they could, you know, disable locomotives and factories and so on in this very, very easy way and very non-detectable way. Problem was that the first shipment of rats was discovered by the Germans, and so they were like, what's this package of 100 dead rats? Opened them up, found the booby trap, and were onto them, and started a big search to, you know, find any other explosive rats. The Special Operations Executive concluded, actually, the trouble and expense that the Germans went to try and find more of the rats made the project actually a success. More of a success than it might have been if they'd blown up a couple of trains.
Dare I say, that is a great example of how the military mind can go, oh, shit, what the... No, it's actually a roaring success.
Yeah.
You were meant to do all along.
But not a rat bomb. But my choice for the world's worst weapon is the bat bomb.
Is this from the same guys?
No, this is from America. The Americans, not happy with a few dead rats with explosives sewn inside them, they went a little bit further. They built a bomb-shaped casing with 1,000 compartments in it to contain hibernating Mexican free-tailed bats with tiny incendiary bombs attached to them.
I've said it before and I will say it again. I feel like in the 20th century, some of the greatest military minds descended into a psychological space most occupied by Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah, this is very much on that. They would drop this bomb at dawn. The casings would, they'd open a parachute, it would open up and the bats would be able to fly out. They'd disperse and roost in the eaves and attics within a 20 to 40 mile radius. The thinking being that eventually when the incendiary bombs went off, they would devastate the Japanese cities they were targeting, because a lot of them were made of wood and paper, of course. So, which obviously later on, firebombing was a major tactic the US used against Japanese cities. But the idea behind it is absolutely, like, ridiculous. The bat bomb was invented or conceived by a dental surgeon from Irwin, Pennsylvania, named Little S. Adams, who was a friend of First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt.
Oh, God.
Basically, he'd been to a national park, he saw lots of bats roosting, and he sent her a letter going... And just shortly after the attack in Pearl Harbor, going, you know what would be a great idea? Would be if you tied bombs to bats.
Did it say that, or did it say...
Yeah, he clearly had the ear of the First Lady, who of course had the ear of the President, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he said, you know, this guy's not an idiot. He must know it. Let's devote some time and money to this. So he said,
I'm Roosevelt. It's the New Deal. We're throwing money at anything.
Yeah, literally anything. The idea, obviously, they then had to assemble a team to look into the project, decide on the type of incendiaries they'd attach. They had to decide, I love this sentence, they had to decide what species of bat to use. After testing several species, the Mexican retail bat was... How did that testing process go? Do you imagine that audition process? It's not really like The Voice or something like that. Or, you know, that bat didn't blow up in quite the right way.
They've had to have erect sort of like fake Japanese villages and send bats off.
They literally did, Ben. Yes, they did.
Great military mind right here.
They carried out a test on a Japanese village, a mock-up of a Japanese city built in Utah. And carried out the definitive test after they picked the right bat. They had to ask for permission from the National Park Service to harvest large numbers of Mexican free-tailed bats.
To be fair, they probably found out about what the Soviets did with the dogs and were like, right, we need to get a bat that's clever enough to know that it's in Japan rather than Utah.
Yes, yes. they also had to figure out how to attach the incendiaries to the bats. They tried various different, you know, tying it on or strapping it on. Eventually, they just went with gluing them to the front of the bats.
They all glue again.
Yeah. It didn't quite make it. That test in Utah did go all right. But a couple of setbacks occurred. In one instance, the Carlsbad Army Air Base in New Mexico was set on fire when armed bats were accidentally released, roosted under a fuel tank, and incinerated the test range. And... it's thought that the development of the bat bomb was hampered a bit too slowly and eventually was overtaken in the race for the quick end to the war by the atomic bomb.
Thank God it didn't last another year. You would have bombs strapped onto the back of a...
Can you imagine the Cold War if this project had actually made it to fruition and it had ended World War II and said suddenly the Germans, the French, the Russians are all trying to build bat bombs instead of nukes?
Oh my God, so yeah, like a bat arms race.
Yeah, it's a wing race.
A wing race, of course.
So it never made it. It never made it to the battlefield, and
Yes.
So for the sheer batty nature of the idea, and the puns write themselves here, I'm going to go with the bat bomb as the world's worst weapon.
Dom, what have you brought for us?
So I've brought a weapon that we've... Let me rephrase that. The thing about a weapon is that you generally want to be able to survive, don't you? You want to be able to survive. You're not, okay, poor old Batty gets it, and Doggy and all the rest of it, and Ratty and Rabbit.
Haven't even talked about the pigeons they were putting in bombs. Yes. I could have spent a lot longer on this.
Or the wind in the willows.
It's got badly wrong.
Have you had frog bombs?
Yeah. The chapter she'd ever finished.
Yeah.
But as a soldier, you generally want to be able to live to fight another day. So there's two aspects to why this is the world's worst weapon. It's just the sheer bonkersness of the weapon itself, and then trying to convince a soldier, you can use this, no dramas, and then go back and pick another one up and off we go, and have them all go, yeah, great idea, great, I'm in. Give me my handheld nuclear missile.
The
M38 Davy Crockett.
What?
And this isn't even one of those bonkers things that was an experiment that was just trial. These were in service for 10 years, from the early 60s to the early 70s in the US service, but in Germany, in West Germany at the time. So the Davy Crockett, which looks like basically sort of an enormous match, there's a missile, but this huge great thing at the end which is a nuclear bomb. And the idea was that the whole idea in the Cold War was that the hordes of Russian tanks would come steaming over from East Germany. We'd all fall back, and there was a geographic feature called the Fulda Gap, which was a big sort of ridge line you could see into the low ground into the east and shoot down all the Russian tanks. And that was going to be the line. That was where we were going to hold the line. That's where all the tanks would be. That's the line. And the plan was that the US infantry would have, there'd be teams of these handheld nuclear missile operators that would fire this thing that would go about 2 kilometres, not 2 kilometres.
What's the fallout zone for one of these?
Well, so that was what they found. They found the explosive charge was, you know, make your eyes water, but it was the immediate fallout that was that would actually be the real killer, let alone what would happen long after that.
And then
these guys were supposed to sort of fire this thing, nuclear explosion.
I like the fact you're miming holding it up to your face now, as if like the metal casing of a nuclear bomb is going to be enough to protect you from immediate face cancer.
just squint.
And
the idea was that you'd then go and pick up another one and off you go. And if you look at photographs of these things, they've got the nuclear radiation symbol, the yellow sort of triangle thing on the front. It just looks so...
Yeah, I've just brought up bonkers. A picture of them there. It is mad. It's like, yeah, it's a really... It's like a cartoon missile. It really is.
It is a cartoon missile. But these were in service. They were actually... I mean, they weren't used, but they were tested. Tested in the US. And they were in Germany.
They were tested by soldiers who lobbed one into another valley and then were never heard of again.
I don't quite know if they actually had soldiers or if they just tied a bit of string around the trigger and then sort of... let it
out. And attached that to a door back and then slammed the door.
They got a lot of Boy Scouts who could do knots.
Yeah.
Did they... I mean, because nuclear stuff was in everything in the 60s. It was in your toys and your food and everything like that. Were they aware of the... beginning to be aware of the dangers of it at that point?
I think there was just a sense of it. We're all going to die. It's going to happen sooner or later. So we might as well, do our bit for Uncle Sam. But I don't know if you'd volunteer for that kind of unit. Who wants to join the handheld nuclear missile?
Yeah, me.
I mean, they fired them. The theory was they'd fire these at advancing Russian tanks.
Yep,
basically,
yep, that was it. They withdrawn. I think withdrawn from Germany in the late '70s. Late '60s, and then decided. Somebody decided. Actually, it's not a very good idea. And so early '70s, they ceased to be. They were known as the Davy Crockett.
Yeah, King of the Royal Frontier. Yeah. I like the. I'm looking at the Wikipedia article for it. It says the weapon did not have an abort function. If fired, the warhead would explode.
Yeah, pesky.
Which, you know, with nuclear weapons, it seems a crucial. Like, people could have a change of heart right up to the moment of impact.
Yeah,
a
lot of Right, go.
Okay. I was reading something the other day that said, wherever you think there's the possibility of there being conspiracy, it's far more likely to be cock-up.
Mm.
And it's the same with nuclear war, that I'm genuinely staggered that there have only ever been 2 nukes fired in anger, because you'd have thought a third one would have been fired by mistake in all of this time. There's the Russian guy on the submarine in the 80s who got what looked like an order from Moscow to fire, and he went, no, there's no good reason for this, I'm going to check, and it was a malfunction. But these guys, surely someone with an itchy trigger finger would just have popped one over to Berlin, of all the places.
There is that idea, that experiment that you leave a child alone in a room for 5 minutes and say, you can have this cake if you don't press the big red button. For 5 minutes, but obviously it's so tempting to have a big red button in the room.
Yeah, I will leave you alone in Central Europe with this big red button. Yeah, you can have it.
Can I trust you guys not to fire the nuclear missile just for fun?
Probably. What would the training protocol look like on it? Or would it just be a fairly normal dispatch system? Like, was the thing that they stuck the nuclear bomb in something that they already had?
I think it was modified, but it was basically an anti-tank missile launcher with this thing stuck on the end.
That's mad.
It's a gun on a tripod. Like, looking at it here, there's a guy standing beside one in the picture.
But you ask about the training for it. There would have been reams of paper written about all the training, because that's what the military does. It plans everything, plans it twice, then chucks those plans away, plans again. It's always planning, always doing lovely drawings. I mean, when I served, it may still be what's taught, but the idea was if you were subjected to a nuclear blast, you were to do the following thing: lie down, face away from the blast, with your hands underneath your body. Okay, right. So hang on a sec. Wait till the second pressure wave passes over you, because the explosion will go out and then it'll get sucked back up again when the mushroom cloud forms. Wait for the second pressure wave to pass over you, and then move to a place of safety.
That's almost like then pop on your bowler hat, pop up your umbrella.
You're thinking, did the person
make sure to put on a scarf for the nuclear winter?
Whoever's typing that out to produce that? Do they actually think, oh, I might, but no one's going to bother with this? I mean, it's not, you know, face away. Hang on, where are they coming from? I need to face away from the blast. Oh, there's another one, bloody hell.
Yeah, well, lick your finger and work out which way the wind's going as well.
Do you... This is a fun question to have to actually ask someone who's an expert in this sort of stuff. What do you think of nuclear weapons? Is there a point to them? In the day and age when, you know, people big enough and bad enough to use them all have them.
You could say the same about any weapon, really. I mean, there's this annoying phrase that the nuclear weapons are a strategic weapon, so it's a political weapon. That will focus the minds. So, well, yeah, a brigade of hairy-ass paratroopers landing on your doorstep is also a bit of a political weapon, really. Annoyingly, with the nuclear situation as it is at the moment, it's almost a case of it's easier to keep doing it rather than not to do it, because there's so much wrapped up in our nuclear industry, the jobs, MPs, constituencies, etc., etc. So there's a heavy slice of the military industry.
It's the same with the environmental stuff. If you go away from fossil fuels, there's a load of fossil fuel jobs and fallout and that thing to deal with. Yeah.
Fallout, probably not great.
No, not a great choice of vision.
But no, I mean, they are ultimately ridiculous, and I would love to think that actually we don't have any.
Mm-hmm.
That it's all a threat, because if you've used them, then you've lost. Right? That's the idea of nuclear diplomacy, that if you have to use it, then you've lost. That's the argument. So why don't we actually plan for not using them? Don't tell anybody. They made an announcement. They actually broke cover a few years ago, about 5 years ago, and said that we've gone down from 225 missiles down to 180. So, breathe a sigh of relief. You know,
only 180 nukes.
We can only wipe out the world, as opposed to the world.
let's just go down to none, and don't tell anyone. Yeah. So they all think we still have.
I
went up to a nuclear-armed and nuclear-powered submarine in Faz Lane a few months ago, and I was speaking to one of the weapons engineers, and I literally, you know, it was the cartel. I was casually sort of leaning on one of the, you know, something down in the forest.
Please don't casually lean on things on a nuclear submarine.
And I said, oh, it must be quite tricky when you load up and you get the old missiles and bung them in the tube. He said, yeah, that's quite tricky, because you get all the protesters outside and all weather dependent, and we don't like moving, though it's not always not good. He said, so the safest thing to do is just to leave them in the tubes. And I go, what? So hang on, wait. The thing I'm leaning on now, that casing there, has got a nuclear weapon behind it. Yeah. Oh my god!
Now regretting shaking your hand when you came.
There was no smoke. Yeah, it's just so bizarre to see the machinery, because this is not, it's not sort of Star Trek or sort of nice. This is old. Yeah. It's metal.
Oh, of course.
Paint peeling, sort of dials, all this kind of stuff. It's old. It looks old, clunky. Because it works, you know, they designed it in the...
Well, because it's floppy disks in the era of the cloud, isn't it?
Yeah.
Still, like, if that makes anyone listening feel any safer.
But still, with a letter. The captain, the commanding officer of the boat has a letter.
Oh, yeah, do you want to tell people about that? Because some British people might know this, but not...
Right, okay, so as far as I know, it is true. It is mentioned in military circles, but I do think it's true. People have told me it is so. That the new Prime Minister, whether or not he or she has just been serving or was newly elected in, after they've done all the big photo call outside, they've been to see the Queen, form me a government, blah, 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 goes back to Downing Street, goes in the door, and the first thing that happens is that they are taken aside by the National Security Advisor or the Chief of the Defence Staff or both or someone of that sort of that position, and asked to write four letters. And these are the letters that will be sent to the commanding officers, the captains, of each of our nuclear-armed submarines, the Vanguard class bombers, as they're known. And these instructions are what you are to do in the event of a war, and you have no further instructions from the UK, because we are no longer here, or something equally catastrophic has happened. And the options that are generally, and these are absolutely super secret, no commanding officer ever opens them, for starters. Thankfully, we haven't had that instance.
Because they're only to open them in the case.
In the event, yeah. And no Prime Minister has ever said what they write in them. But it's generally accepted to be either fire missiles at your primary and secondary targets.
Which is trickier now. It's back in the day, it was shoot missiles at Moscow. Now it's... Yeah. Now it's gas.
Just go bombers. Yeah. Or go to Australia and just stay the hell out of there.
Have a gap year.
under your initiative.
Or not necessarily a safe option nowadays either, going to Australia.
No, not with nuclear missile. But,
no.
Or most likely, it's go to the US and place yourself under the command of the President of the USA.
Oh, so, no. Jesus. And is there another thing about the Today Show as well? Is that a, if you can hear, if the Today Show isn't on Radio 4, basically Britain has fallen. Yeah.
Well, no, I feel that way about Test Match Special.
Yes.
Like every time I'm like, oh God, you know, society's going to hell in a handcart, we'll all be eating out of bins, and it'll be like The Road by 2035.
Yeah.
And then I listen to Blowers, and it's all right.
Again, an unfortunate name for somebody involved in Britain.
I think the biggest problem with the nukes, am I right in thinking that an awful lot of our nuclear weapons are in Scotland, and that's because that's where a lot of the nuclear submarines
are. All our submarines, nuclear armed and conventional hunter killers, they are all, well, they're in the process of all going up to
That's because they've got deep enough moorings.
Well, they have. It's also because they're closing down the Navy are closing down the port down in England, but and that's where it's all going to be. It's all going to be up in Faslane, which is just outside Glasgow.
I mean, surely that's going to make Scottish independence a bit of a hot topic, because Nicola Sturgeon is going to go, bye, and we're taking all the nukes.
She doesn't need a submarine, she's a sturgeon.
Yeah, freshwater. A freshwater politician.
Oh, dear. Welcome to the show. Go back and tell the Telegraph we sent.
Tell them, I'm going to use that.
To start off, we're going to go back to antiquity and to the Greeks, and we're going to hear about some more harm done to animals. So, that's the noise that they make. obviously, most famously, Hannibal used elephants to transport troops across the Alps, but war elephants were used by all sorts of different enemies of the Greeks and the Romans.
It was a much bigger budget version of War Horse, though.
Yes. So the Greeks were like, right, what can we use as like a natural elephant repellent?
And mice.
It wasn't mice. It was the pig. They thought that the natural enemy of the elephant was the pig. And so when they were besieged by Macedonia and their war elephants, the Greeks released pigs, but not just any pigs. They released pigs coated in tar and then set alight.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
And the smell of bacon was enough.
Yeah, the elephant's like, oh, God, I've got such a hangover. I'm just going to follow that.
I was imagining they just would wind up the springy tail on the pig, press it against the ground and release. And they'd act as some sort of, like, porcine mortar.
That's
which is two words I've never put together in my life.
Porcine mortar. Another tangentially related animal weapon is a particular type of volley gun. Now, a volley gun is something that can fire more than one projectile at the same time. They're sort of like ancestors of machine guns, in a way.
Okay.
Even sort of like rifles where you'd have one barrel on top of another. But people wanted to see how many projectiles they could fire at once.
I've seen these pictures.
Yeah. So there was some way you could have like up to like 25 different barrels shooting stuff. But someone went, I'd really like to make these portable, and they created the Duckfoot pistol, which is, I'll show you a picture of it.
Oh my.
It looks like a duck's foot, and the four webs fire four different projectiles out of them. They weren't very accurate, you'll be amazed to know.
Yeah, you astound me then.
Yeah, so in 1835, Giuseppe Marco Fieschi used a homemade 25-barrel volley gun.
25?
Yeah, to attempt to assassinate King Louis-Philippe I in Paris.
And his entire retinue, all in one go?
He fired it from a third-floor window of a book depository. And although 18 people were killed...
That's not bad. Right. That's 75% hit rate.
Yeah, the king only received a minor flesh wound.
What did Fieschi receive?
He was badly injured in doing it, because often these things would backfire a little bit, and was quickly captured.
Oh, God.
Safer with a Davy Crockett nuclear.
Probably were.
How are these 24 barrels arranged?
I think it was a triangle. So it's sort of like the way the balls are arranged before a snooker. Frame snooker.
To get it loaded, does he have a guy in a suit and white gloves? Each of the bullets.
He has to shine each bullet before it goes in.
Yeah, a bit of chalk on the end of it.
Yeah, and after he'd shot it, just a voice went, Giuseppe Fieschi, 24. But I'm going to spend a lot of time wandering around World War II, because this... we haven't barely scratched the surface of some of the batshit stuff in there. So I think we've spoken before about Operation Sea Lion, which was the Nazi plans to invade Britain in 1940. And obviously the biggest problem for them was, what do you do about the Channel? And they came up with something called Tauchpanzers. And Tauchpanzers were waterproof panzer tanks.
Amazing.
And so they converted 254 normal panzers into deep wading tanks that they even called Unterwasserpanzers, underwater panzers.
Even I can translate that into German. Because I think we might have talked about this before. The channel isn't that deep. If you could fit St. Paul's into the channel and still see the dome over the top of it. That's how relatively not deep the channel is.
So what they did, they fitted the tanks with waterproofing, obviously, everywhere. And then,
good that was number one on the list.
Yes. I think we need to soundproof these first so that...
No, come on, we need a breakout room.
And then they basically put an 18-metre long rubber hose... from where the troops were up to a boat that sort of escorted it across the channel.
Each tank needed a chaperone boat.
Pretty much. So you can imagine kind of like the Home Guard on the White Cliffs of Dover going, what is that enormous fleet doing moving really slowly across the channel?
So basically, these boats were taking panthers for a walk.
Yeah. Operation Sea Lion never went ahead. I presume it's the Battle of Britain distracted, basically wasting everyone's time. It basically meant that...
Well, hang on, sorry. Sorry, Ben. If you're sending boats over the channel anyway, why don't you put the fucking tanks on the boats?
Because they'd sink the boat.
Build a big enough boat! How small are these boats that are holding the tube? Is it just one guy in a rowboat holding the tube, one hand doing the oars, having to swap sides every now and again, holding the tube in the other?
They weren't very big boats.
Okay.
Is what I'm saying.
I'm not holding you personally responsible for the failure of Operation Sea Lion. Far from it, as a Jewish man.
You and your Unterwasser.
Yeah, Ben, back to the drawing
board. Well, that's the big reveal. Part of the family van der Velde had actually infiltrated the German Navy and came up with this idea. But don't worry. It wasn't just the Nazis who were coming up with ridiculous plans.
Oh,
during
good.
World War
I was worried
two.
For a moment.
One of the big problems with the start of World War II was that the planners wanted to try and avoid everything descending into trench warfare again, because it was, you know, it's a charnel house and a meat grinder for human beings.
It's no fun at all.
No, absolutely not at all.
No bants, lads.
Yeah. No, the bants was the one good thing in the trenches, if Journey's End is anything to believe.
Yes, this is true.
Obviously, for the first 8 or 9 months of World War II, there was the phony war where nothing much happened and loads of fortifications went up across the Western Front. And Churchill wanted to find a way of basically getting through the trenches. And so he set about developing, with the War Office, a military trench-digging machine called Cultivator No. 6. Its original code name was White Rabbit No. 6.
Great.
Because it was, you know, burrowing down amongst warrens. Yeah. It wasn't alluding to Lewis Carroll, but it was alluding to Churchill's metaphorical ability to pull ideas out of a hat.
Oh, okay. He wasn't a fan of Jefferson Airplane either.
A time-travelling fan of Jefferson Airplane. It was made by NLE Tractors Limited, and so it was commonly referred to as either Nelly or Churchill's Mole. Because a lot of the Admiralty moved away from London during the war, because they wanted to be, just in case, London was hit by the Blitz.
Yes, our brave boys.
Yes, the genesis of this experiment was in the Grand...
He liked Genesis as well, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Desperate times.
The genesis of it began in the Grand Pump Room Hotel in Bath. And my favourite thing about it is the initial investigations of the feasibility of this project was put into the hands of a gentleman, an engineer, called Frank Spanner. Cognitive determinism at work there.
But Spanner in the works.
Yes, exactly. And this was one of these things that eventually it became... went from a white rabbit to a white elephant. Hmm. It just... made no sense. It didn't work properly because it was what they basically needed was the thing that they used to build the channel tunnel, that sort of level of hardware to take away the earth, and it just couldn't work fast enough. And Churchill, when it became clear that the machines were not going to be used in combat, Churchill in his memoirs said, "I am responsible but impenitent."
You gotta, in fairness to them, like, as people who work in the arts a lot of the time, when you're creating shows, you're sort of meant to think like there are no wrong answers, and you gotta, you know, gotta be open to ideas and creative things. And the army didn't really think that they'd be the people who'd be like, yeah, there's literally no wrong answer. Yeah, we're gonna investigate literally every possible.
Take that phrase and run with it.
Yeah.
But we're going to go to a slightly different department, to your special operations executive?
Special operations executive. Yes, whose mission from Churchill, they were given three words, and that was their mission: set Europe ablaze.
Ooh. What a brilliant job!
Great!
Wow. I want you to go and set Europe. That's it, off you go. Give you a load of money, a load of crazy weirdos, go and set Europe ablaze. Absolutely phenomenal.
Brexit, yeah. Brexit party slogan for the next election.
Once we're out.
Yeah.
I was like, just go and do me a fireworks display, lads. Well, here there was another department, the Department of Miscellaneous Weapons Development. They were also known as the Wheezers and Dodgers, because they had to come up with Wheezers and Dodgers for the army. The two things that I'm going to tell you about, one was called Hadjelay. And Hadjelay was basically an experimental project for airdropping supplies using retro rockets. They basically drop the supplies out of a plane and sort of like Elon Musk's thing,
oh
yeah,
my God,
use rockets to slowly lower it down to Earth.
Oh, right, okay.
But this was... and the reason why they're called Hadjelay is because Hadjelay is Elijah in reverse, and the rockets coming down apparently looked like, well, reminded them of the Prophet Elijah's chariot of fire.
Of course.
According to the attending officer, Captain Jock Davis. The problem with this, well, there were so many problems.
Did they have a separate department to come up with fucking stupid names for all
Yeah, Spike Milligan was in charge of it. The first problem was like getting, like, you know, not all landers equal, so getting it to land level was really difficult.
Yes.
Sorting out the weight was really difficult, so often they had to send down like a plumb line to sort of hit the ground first, which sort of like defeated the purpose of the rockets going down. They also could never get permission from the MOD to give them things to practice with. Eventually, they managed to get some jeeps to test as a prototype, but it proved really difficult for them to jettison them from a plane at a height of 2,000 feet, because they were essentially strapping explosive rockets to a jeep and chucking it out of the plane.
hell of a stag do.
Yeah, they got a couple of jeeps from the United States Navy. The first one, they for some reason tested it on a day with heavy snowfall. The rockets didn't fire and the whole rig crashed to the ground. They did a bit of tinkering, and then the second time round, the rockets fired successfully, the jeep landed but upside down.
50-50.
And
someone said, heads, I win.
Yeah, the last attempt was on the morning of the Normandy landings.
They were still testing this on the morning of the Normandy landings. Wait, guys, don't go. We're still going to do it.
So it was being tested on the ground, and an electrician was unaware the device was live, began to test the wiring, and accidentally connected the firing circuit.
Oh.
All of the rockets fired up, the platform shot 40 feet in the air, lurched sideways, and then crashed back to Earth, injuring some crew who were underneath it. But that wasn't nearly as stupid as the Great Panjandram, which was so close to being my selection. So one of the biggest problems that the British military had to overcome in World War II was the Atlantic Wall, which was the enormous sort of front going all the way down the coast of Norway, Germany, Denmark, Belgium, yada yada. And it was 10 foot high, 7 foot thick, concrete defences, and the British military were like, right, how are we going to get through this? And what they came up with was essentially two enormous Catherine wheels connected to a drum full of explosives that they would attempt to skim along the ocean and then crash through the wall.
They played a very big game of bowling.
Yeah, they did, which it sort of looks like weaponized tumbleweed, which is the effect that it had. So,
and the reception it got in the pitch meeting.
Yeah, oh, well, it got a fascinating reception. So it was... predicted that with a full 4,000-pound load, it would reach speeds of 60 miles an hour. They constructed the prototype at Leytonstone and transported it to Devon. And they were like, right, we're just going to like test it secretly here in Devon.
Sorry, I like that they built this weapon and they went, hang on, we can't leave this around in Essex. The last thing they need.
Yeah. So we'll go out and fire it at the Scilly Isles.
Yeah.
So they took it to Devon. And they chose a beach that they thought would be quiet. However, it was a popular destination for holidaymakers.
Another classic military intelligence.
Yeah, God. Yes, we've found the perfect place, sir. What? Yeah. Isn't that a Nobly Knees competition taking place? Yeah. No. Are those donkeys? No. They are military combatants.
Yes. Are those donkeys on fire? There must be some Greek holidaymakers here. So the first time they tested it, rockets on the right wheel failed and the weapon just careered off course. And they kept doing it, but every occasion the Panjandrum lost control and failed to reach the end of the beach. After a bit more tinkering for 3 weeks, they launched it again. It hurtled towards the coast, skimming the beach before turning back out to sea and exploding there. Despite the failures, they kept persevering. They tried putting wheels on it. They took the wheels off because that got caught in the sea. They attached steel cables to it to get some sort of steering, but the Panjandrum was too powerful and snapped the cables, and these metal cables whipped back across the beach. The final test with like the top brass there to watch it, there was a cameraman who was there watching it. They fired it off and then a clamp clamping the rockets on gave way until three broke away and it lurched ominously and it hit a line of craters in the sand, turned to starboard and started careering towards the cameraman. But he was viewing it through a telescopic lens and so misjudged the distance and kept filming.
Oh no.
And so there's this amazing footage of this thing getting closer and closer and closer, and only when he heard the roar did he look out from behind his viewfinder and was like, oh, I better run. And this thing, this giant drum is coming towards him, shedding rockets everywhere and as he ran for cover, he glimpsed all the assembled admirals and generals also diving for cover at the same time, and apparently it got so close and then as if the hand of God came down, it turned back and went out to sea again and exploded, raining down rockets on the beach.
It's like it decided, am I going to be a comedy or a tragedy?
Yeah. So that was almost going to be my suggestion until I found a gun designed in 1718 by a gentleman called James Puckle. And this was the world's first rapid-fire weapon. Now, at the time in the...
Sounds good.
Yeah, it sounds like a great idea, doesn't it?
So far, so good.
Yeah, you know.
Apart from the date of invention, that puts me on edge.
Yeah, 160 years before the Maxim gun, and there was quite a few problems that hadn't been ironed out. Obviously, at this time, it was muskets that were normally used, and they were pretty slow. The best musketeers could fire about 3 shots a minute.
Okay.
This gun... it was claimed, it resembled like a revolver on a tripod, could fire 63 shots in 7 minutes, so 9 a minute. So there were several reasons that this really, really didn't work. First of all, was he had 2 different kinds of bullet for the most gloriously stupid and racist reason you will ever hear.
Oh, no.
He had regular musket balls to fire at civilised people and square bullets to fire at the Muslim Turks. And the idea being that he believed that square bullets would hurt more, and the ability to make square bullets showed the benefits of a Christian civilisation because only we can make square bullets rather than the Turks.
Proper aerodynamic, were they?
not hugely. So... a number of problems. Firstly, there's no empirical evidence that a square bullet hurts any more or less than a round bullet. Secondly, there were all sorts of unnecessary extra parts that made the gun harder to manufacture. Also, it made it really difficult for the people operating them because they essentially had to ask the person they were firing at what their religion was before they popped the gun in.
Had to read them the Miranda rights.
Yeah, exactly. So, only 2 guns were ever known to have been made, and they were both bought by John Montagu, who was the Master General of the Ordnance, and he used them on an unsuccessful expedition in 1722 to capture St. Lucia and St. Vincent. According to the shipping manifests, there was no evidence that the guns were ever used. A weapon that was badly designed, badly conceived, had bad intentions behind it, was rarely produced and then never used. And
what shape were the barrels? If he was getting both, you know, globes and cubes into them.
Oh, good point. It's sort of like a pick-and-mix gun, isn't it?
Because then you're going to end up... Do you have, like, a toddler trying to load it? Like they do with those little shaped toys. You try and get the right shape through the right hole...
Yeah, that's possibly overestimating the intelligence level of the fire, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Our suggestion for the world's worst weapon are as follows. Barry has come up with the DC Comics-inspired Bat Bomb. Dom has suggested the greatest nuclear weapon in the wild frontier, the M38 Davy Crockett, and mine of the heretic-slaying Puckle Gun. Good work, lads. This is a huge array of terrible weaponry.
I like that we've got like a bomb, a missile, and a gun as well. We've got
a slightly different around.
Yeah.
Something for everyone.
I, because we celebrate harm to animals far too much on this show, I'm going to disqualify the bat bomb.
Sorry, let me just be clear. I'm not celebrating it. I'm just putting it before the jury as evidence yet again that humans are idiots.
Well, also, the thing with your bat bomb, I think you mentioned birds with the sulfur on them.
Yes.
That's actually inspired by Chinese weapons from the 14th century, the firebirds, who they would do it with real birds, but also sort of... wickerwork birds that they would fly into their opponents' villages and set them on fire.
Yeah.
So, sorry, mate, the Chinese got there first.
They did, as with most things, to be honest.
So I'm torn between the not very often used Puckle Gun and the thankfully not used M38 Davy Crockett. I think just that the sheer idiocy in the modern age of the Davy Crockett, I think it's got to be that. Because
good name, though. Good name, though.
It is a good name.
It's the only good thing about it.
Yeah.
And the fact that it exists, I could just about understand a battlefield nuke in 1945 when people don't fully realise the extent of its power. But in the 60s, we've seen it. So yeah, I'm gonna suggest that. So well done. I'm delighted that the military expert has picked up this weapon.
You can hold your head up high when you go back to work.
Before we go our separate ways, it's time for the world's worst news of the week. And we're going to Australia. Obviously, horrible times are going in Australia. But one innovative and entrepreneurial cook has found a silver lining. He pulled up his Datsun car in Perth, Western Australia. He opened up the back seat. He opened up the back door, threw in a slab of pork, closed it, and because of the extreme hot temperatures, 10 hours later, he had pulled pork.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
The temperature inside the Datsun peaked at 81 degrees Celsius. That's 177 degrees Fahrenheit.
It's perfect for slow cooking.
Right?
Ah, it's ideal.
It really is.
And it's got the oil in the machine, presumably, as well.
And probably some sort of flavour from the leather on the seats.
Yeah, plastic leather at sea.
Yeah, delish.
Yeah, so obviously he said he was illustrating why it is very important not to leave pets in hot cars, and at all times, particularly now. But he also signed off by going, in a very louche Aussie way, a quiche would cook in a couple of hours, I reckon.
To be clear, it was a slab of pork and not a live pig.
Yes, it was a slab of pork that the Greek military were very interested in. Before we toddle off out into the world, Dom, where can people find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
So I'm at Dom Nichols on Twitter. I'm at The Telegraph, dominic.nichols at telegraph.co.uk. Any and all pitches, the weirder the better. And online in the paper and... round them out.
Happy days. We're all off to pitch my first Puckle Gun to the Early Learning Centre. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.